This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. At this point, the design historian Stephen Heller has literally written more books than most people have read. But his latest one is his magnum opus. It's called Iron Fists. It is a big, richly illustrated book with an elegant thesis about the great horrors of the 20th century, that the four big totalitarian states, Nazi Germany, Fascist Italy, Soviet Russia, and Maoist China, were all expertly branded by their leaders. Steve Heller, welcome to Studio 360.
It's great to be here.
So, Hitler, Mussolini, Stalin, Mao, what made these evil guys such expert branders?
Well, at the top of that list is the Nazis. They weren't the first, but they did it the best. And what they created was an identity around two things. One is their trade character, or what I call a trade character, Adolf Hitler, and the other is their trademark, the swastika.
Now trade character is a term of art in the branding world for Mr. Clean and Bob's Big Boy and
the Frito Bandito.
Some people might be offended that you're suggesting these guys like Mao and Hitler are equivalent.
Well, they are, because what you see is their face, and that visage becomes a symbol. In addition to being a human being, it is a mark of an ideology. It's a mark of a regime. It's a mark of a religion.
And as you say, the swastika even more was a kind of brilliant adoption by Hitler himself early on of this age-old symbol.
He was actually quite jealous of the Soviets. He wanted a hammer and sickle of his own. He wanted a red flag of his own. And so he developed something. He developed a brand that was memorable and caused great pride, allowed for people, enabled people to be proud of the nation and proud of the party.
And you quote him talking in Mein Kampf about the importance of this kind of thinking for a movement.
It was very key. He realized that people needed affiliations, and they needed physical affiliations, concrete affiliations, and that was done through badges. I mean, he called his logo a badge. It was done through flags. It was done through banners. And ultimately, it was done through spectacle. So it wasn't just the two-dimensional graphics. It was three-dimensional graphics. It was stagecraft.
The Nuremberg rallies and the lights, of which we've seen only glimpses in Leni Riefenstahl.
Right, and ultimately the architecture. The architecture for Hitler, Hitler wanted to be an architect. Goebbels kept saying, Hitler is an artist who saved the nation, and once the nation was totally saved, he would be an artist again. What's interesting, and with all of these dictators, save for Lenin, they all had aspirations towards art in some fashion. Mussolini was a writer. He was a novelist, a published novelist. The Cardinal's Mistress was his book. Mao was one of the great calligraphers, and that was because he understood the power of the graphic.
Do you remember the first time that these symbols and these graphic schemes grabbed you?
I went briefly to a military school, so I was kind of into that regalia. And indeed, it is something. It is a tonic.
What do you mean it's a tonic?
Well, when you earn and wear the medals, the patches, the insignia, you feel like you're part of something. You feel like you're in a tribe. And that's what all branders try to do. They try to make tribes out of people, loyal consumers of their particular product or ideology. So I was seduced in that way. But the first time I was ever struck by the power of these things, the negative power, was when I was going through my grandmother's drawer one day and came across a postcard that was returned to her after the war. And it was stamped with these swastikas and symbols of Grosse Deutschland, the eagle. And they just kind of took my breath away and gave me a pit in my stomach.
Some of the early Nazi graphics that you have in the book are modern and gorgeous. And when I look at them and feel, this is beautiful, I feel guilty and wrong for having that perception. Did you go through that as you went through this trove of stuff?
Definitely. At first, I didn't want to collect this material. For years, as much as it appealed to me, I passed by the dealers, the offerings, the resources that I would need to create a book like this. And finally, I just gave in, and I felt guilty every time I acquired an object. But I also felt this elation every time I found an object that I had never seen before. And I was buying things from some strange people and realized—
Who may or may not be sympathizers.
Who may or may not be suspect. Now, I also took great pleasure in buying Italian fascist material because there was such a beauty to it. The Nazi stuff is striking. It's strong. It's strident. But the Italian fascist was kind of Mediterranean dictator. You know, it was beautiful colors, soothing typefaces. There was a whole different aesthetic and a whole different gestalt for these images until the war began, and then all propaganda changes.
In talking about the Italian fascist graphics, you call it carnivalesque. Give me an example or two of what you mean by that.
In Italy, to capture the youth, or the flowers of youth, as they were called, they created graphics that were youth-oriented. They were based on comics. They were based on cartoons. They were colorful. They were lighthearted. They were carnivalesque. And that was something that these kids could respond to. And at the same time, they promoted the wearing of particular uniforms and badges, and not unlike the Boy Scouts of America. I hope no lightning bolt hits me, but that's what these things were. They were these Boy Scout groups that taught these kids to be ideological soldiers.
We have a song from 1936, Fascist Italy. Let's listen to that.
Verso Roma passo militare, oggi tutta Italia marcerà.
Vuoi vedere il fronto pieno?
Il nostro amato duce vuole ognuno ringraziar.
Pace e fior ai vincitori,
ai fanti vittoriosi d'oltremar.
So that's propaganda music, but certainly carnivalesque. You can imagine the Looney Tune of which that's the soundtrack.
You can, but you can also detect, even if you can't speak Italian, the word duce. And duce was the leader.
It was Mussolini.
Benito Mussolini. And he was omnipresent. You hear that over and over again. It becomes melodic. It becomes a cadence. Duce, duce, duce. And that's all part of the branding.
Graphically, they used his face, his silhouette, in a way, based on the evidence of your book, more than anybody else's.
You know, you think the skateboarders invented stenciling on walls, but they didn't. It was Duce. It was Mussolini who knew that his face should be on every building to remind the populace that this was the guy. This was their man, their big brother.
The fact that his image was so abstracted and immediately recognizable in this highly abstracted form really does suggest, as you say, that these people, in his case especially, became these like trade characters where, that's Alki Alka-Seltzer. That's, Pillsbury Doughboy. Oh, it's Mussolini. I mean, it's to that degree of kind of instant recognizability.
Totally. And his son-in-law, Count Ciano, who was at one time responsible for propaganda in the Italian state, said that Mussolini was more interested in the myth of fascism than the reality, that he was more interested in the way he looked and the way his followers looked than the actual policy. And so the policy became the myth. It was a complex absorption. I mean, it was narcissism on the highest level, but it was also charisma that came out of that narcissism.
So you're almost suggesting that Italian fascism was a giant art project of which the ideology was just tacked on to justify.
Ultimately, I'd say it was, tragically so. I mean, if it was kept as an art project, it would have been nice in a gallery instead of in terms of a nation. But many of these things, and Hitler was the same way. I mean, Hitler was an artist at heart who saw politics as a tool of his art.
Well, and you start the book with a very prescient Walter Benjamin quote about fascism being essentially that.
Fascism is the aestheticization of politics. It's a brilliant line. And these dictatorships managed to embrace that and use that better than anybody else. In democracies, you just don't seem to have that because you cannot set those rules. I mean, even in the United States, there's no real law about the use of the American flag. Anybody can have it. Anybody can use it. Anybody can use the red, white, and blue in any which way. But there were rules about how these brands could be used by the populace.
Although apparently we've discovered that if you're running for president, you have to have a flag pin. That's a rule. And that was an unwritten rule.
An unwritten rule, but we'll see where that goes.
One wonders. I was just in Beijing and I saw all these fantastic new buildings that they've commissioned. And I felt my heart and mind softening to the Chinese regime. Oh, look, this Rem Cool House building. Oh, look, Steve Hull has built this great building there. It is soft power of at least a kind of analogous kind.
It is. It's a different kind of propaganda for a different purpose. It's not the hard-edged ideology that propaganda was trying to embrace when Mao was forging the Cultural Revolution, in part because Mao thought his power had been usurped. And he, in fact, literally gave up his power, so he wanted it back. So it was all about power. This is about power in a different way. This is about economic power. This is about showing the world that they can rise above the old communist strictures.
Obviously, the Nazis and Mussolini, both fascists, China and the Soviet Union, both communists. But there are clearly broad differences in all kinds of ways. Did you find any striking differences one to the next?
What I found that was striking was Germany's use of modernism, even though they called it cultural Bolshevism. What I found in Italy was they embraced modernism. But this was all opportunistic stuff. The Germans used modernism in their architecture and in some of their graphics when it suited them, when they needed it. And I find that that was a similarity in those two fascist regimes, one totally anti-modernist and the other embracing modernism until it no longer worked for them. In terms of the Chinese model, it was all based on the Soviet socialist realism, and it was based to a certain extent on folk arts. They tried to integrate a little bit of folk art with their Soviet-style propaganda.
Which is to say, sort of highly realistic, kitschy pictures of heroic workers and soldiers fighting the aggressor or looking toward the sky and the future.
Right. It was all romanticized. You know, sometimes Mao smiled, sometimes he didn't. By the way, Mao never brushed his teeth. But in the posters, when he's smiling, you see white teeth. If you were to see a photograph of him, you'd see black. So these were posters like advertising posters, like those great images you see on Mad Men that were meant to make the American woman and the American male look heroic. I mean, that's what this was doing for their trade character.
Stephen Heller, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Steve Heller's new book is called Iron Fists, and you can see images from it at studio360.org.